The year today's album came out, Elvis performed a live televised show from Hawaii that reached more worldwide viewers than the Apollo moon landing. The Miami Dolphins completed the only perfect season in NFL history, going 17-0 on a route to the Super Bowl XII victory. Pink Floyd released Dark Side of the Moon, Secretariat won the Triple Crown, and offensive action in Vietnam ended with the signing of the Paris Peace Accords. And finally, Richard Tricky Dick Nixon extolled to the world, "I am not a crook," on live TV in relation to the Watergate scandal that rocked the world and eventually led to his disgraced resignation. The artist for this week's album has sold more than 150 million records of his 12 studio albums and numerous live events. Raised in the Bronx and learned to play on a deserted piano in an attic supported by phone books. You've probably guessed the year, it was 1973. The artist is my all-time favorite musician and storyteller, William Martin Joel. The album? His second studio album, Piano Man, today on Two Dudes and Tunes. You're listening to Two Dudes and Tunes, the show that puts two unlikely heroes on a magical musical journey. My name is Wood, and I'm joined, as always, by the Thelma to my Louise, Chris Robinson. Chris, how are things in the tippy top of Texas?
Well, Wood, spoilers for a 30-year-old movie, but it is taking a long time for this car to get to the bottom of a cliff. Just keep waiting.
It's a 34-episode car crash at the moment.
Yeah, it's taking such a long time. It's so we mentioned this, I think, last episode or the episode that will be last episode. I'm all turned around on time. But my show notes are still out of date because we had such a long gap. But yeah, things are pretty good, honestly. Not a whole lot to report.
Yeah,
honestly, if you've got anything, jump right in because I don't have a whole lot to talk about.
So we'd mentioned my temporary boss being a lot to work with after my boss had retired, the guy who hired me, and I guess. In the whole process, I had the opportunity, I was invited to interview for that position, and I was told by a bunch of people that I was a qualified candidate for it, and then didn't end up getting the job, which was kind of a letdown, and neither did my best friend in the whole wide world, so that kind of sucked. But he was offered an even better position somewhere else, still within the company I work for, but on a different team. And the guy that they just announced as the replacement for my old boss is kind of an unknown to me, but he picked up the phone and he called me the other day and we had about an hour and a half long conversation about where our team is going and what we need to be doing. And I got to say, I'm pretty excited about him. I'm waiting with bated breath to see, you know, what the honeymoon phase looks like. And, you know, we've all had new bosses, so like, what's this really going to be like? But right now it's looking pretty cool.
Well, good.
Yeah.
Good.
So, and then, I don't know. I've been getting ready for the football season and I've got this, I've got this real hankering to, for some reason, work on this old Land Cruiser I have in my garage. So I've been putting together lists and trying to figure out what that's going to cost me. And I'm sure Tiffany's really excited about that, but that's for another day. Right now, we got a podcast to record.
Absolutely. Would sing me a song about Piano Man.
All right, Chris, Piano Man. This album came out November 9th, 1973. It's the second studio album by Billy Joel, which is probably one of the cooler album stories out there. And we'll get into that here in a little bit, just because of you know, Billy Joel's notorious kind of troubles with management and record labels over the years and personality issues that he has with different kinds of people. So this album was his second studio album after he basically walked out on strike on his prior recording label over the fact they botched the release of his first studio album. And he famously, the first time he heard his first studio album, threw it out the window and from that day on refused to do anything else with the recording label because they pressed the album at the wrong speed and then sent it to market. And so he sounded like a chipmunk the whole album through.
I cannot, I think we even touched on this at the end of last episode. Mm-hmm. I cannot imagine the rage I would experience. Like, as somebody who plays music and, you know, works really hard to be, as the U.S. Army used to put it in the 90s, to be all that I could be. like, I don't know how you could do anything else in his shoes.
Yeah.
You know, like, well, that's a deal breaker. If you imagine like Steven Spielberg releasing a theater or a movie in theaters, like if
the aspect ratio was squeezed into the wrong aspect ratio.
Exactly. Or if it ran backwards or something, like it's just inconceivable. Like I don't know how you would allow that to happen. Yeah. So I'm on Team Joel, to be clear.
And what's interesting is he really didn't spend that much time out of a record contract or out, you know, on strike, if you will. It was really only about 6.5 or 7 months before he got released from his prior contract and was able. He signed with Columbia and had two concurrent record deals, one with the prior company and one with Columbia, but he couldn't release anything because anything he released would have been the other company's material.
Yeah.
So he basically got a living stipend from Columbia to go live in a basement in California and play at a piano bar for 6 months while they got his contract bought out. And that's when he wrote most of the tracks for this album, was during that hiatus while not performing for the first contract. So kind of an interesting side. My first exposure to this album, kind of like with most music that was released before 1996, let's say, was probably my dad. And I remember the first time I ever heard this album, I was 12 or 13 years old, and it was in the back seat of his 1984 Toyota Land Cruiser, which we had just gotten back on the road. It had been wrecked when we bought it, and he tore it apart in our driveway with kind of this lesson of when I turned 16, that was going to be my car. And in order for me to get my license at 16, I had to repair this wrecked Land Cruiser. And it had had a slow speed crash with like a telephone pole or a tree or something on the driver's side front corner. So we replaced the hood, the fenders, you know, the headlight, you know, it was a bunch of little work. And then we painted it, you know, did a bunch of little stuff to it to get it back on the road and safe, rebuilt the brakes, did a whole bunch of stuff, but it had no stereo when we bought it. And so when all the work was done, we went to Mother's Window Tint here in San Antonio and had a car stereo installed on Broadway. And they installed that. And on the way home, my dad popped the CD for this album into the CD player. And we listened to it. And it was the first time I remember ever hearing the album. And I remember just being utterly floored by it. I was sitting shotgun because, you know, no airbags and any of that. And so I'm sitting there shotgun with him. And there's just something, even to my untrained musical sensibilities as a 12 or 13 year old, that had a lot of symmetry to it. And I identified with the different characters of the songs, even as a 13 year old, that just made it something that I knew immediately I was going to like. So that's kind of it in a nutshell for me, like the whole early experience, it being my dad bringing it to me. And then over the years, as I've become a bigger and bigger Billy Joel fan, something he's one artist I never shut up about, and I think you get tired of hearing me talk about him.
No, I really don't. I've been, you know, since the Oracle called this album up last week.
It was about time, because four of his albums are on my list and it's down to like 20 albums. So
you're like, come on, Oracle.
Anytime now. Rolling.
Man, but I have just been binging his discography because much like you, my introduction to Billy Joel was through my dad. So my dad had two best of collections that I remember very vividly. And they were both actually kind of similar. They were both double disc CD jewel cases.
Yes.
So the real chunky, like 3/4 of an inch thick, almost, maybe even like 1¼ inches. But he had one of Elton John's music, which I listened to a lot, and one of Billy Joel's music, which I listened to a lot. So my kind of formative years, and this is like, I want to say these memories are from maybe 2nd or 3rd grade. So pretty early in my life. And I remember listening to the song Piano Man quite a bit because, you know, it's such an indelible sound.
It is the quintessential piano ballad. Like it is. If somebody says name a piano ballad, it's definitely Piano Man.
Piano Man. And you know, half of that may be because the word piano is in the song, so it's just a trick of association. But
it's a piano ballad about a piano player playing in a piano bar. Like it is just.
It's it is as on brand for piano as you can get. But I loved that song. I'm sure that I played that track ad nauseum on my little CD player that I had. And I remember actually, so I tried to learn the lyrics to it and sing along with it very early on in life. And I got in trouble about the businessmen slowly getting stoned because, you know, I'm a little kid. I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
But my mom did not like that I was singing about yuppies turning to alcoholism to cope with their like terrible lifestyle. And so I don't know that I got in significant trouble. But I think I was told like, hey, don't sing that.
It was
like, at least not around people we know.
Exactly. Don't sing this song at church, honey. I remember distinctly learning the difference between a melody and a medley because of this song. Yeah. So,
oh, nice. Yeah. Two very different things.
Both mentioned in this song.
When I was in, the worship band, I would complain vociferously about having to play worship medleys because the problem with medleys from a musical standpoint is that you only get snippets of your favorite songs. Mm-hmm. And so you don't get the pleasure of playing the whole thing. It's kind of like, I don't know, it's showing up to a buffet half full where it's like, I would like to eat 2 or 3 of everything.
Yeah.
But I had a late lunch and it's hot outside. So
the
anyway,
only thing I can play is the chorus and then we're on to the next chorus and to the next chorus.
Exactly. That has nothing to do with anything, but here we are. That was my introduction to Billy Joel. And, you know, it's kind of funny. I really thought I had listened to more of his discography than I had, but I think it's just because you and I talked about Billy Joel so much. I just thought like, oh, yeah, I'm familiar with his music and I'm familiar with his hits, but he's got a lot of deep cuts that are just excellent.
So my favorite thing about his music, in all honesty, is actually the deep cuts. He's got a lot of great hits. He's got a lot of tunes that are really memorable and people love. And you go buy a greatest hits album of his and it's got 65 songs on it. I mean, it's pretty crazy how stacked his discography is with good music.
It really is.
Or popular music. I mean, his music just has this timeless kind of quality to it. even though this was released in 1973 and there's talk about payphones and all sorts of other 1970s antiquated technology, it's something you can still connect to and think through in a way, mainly because his stories focus on people, not the technology, not the things that are going on. It's the people involved. And as long as you can connect with those people, you have a connection to the song that's more than just the time that it was created in. I mean, you think about what a piano bar would be like today. There's one in New Braunfels here close to where we live that you go there and there's some guy, you know, plinking away at the keys and he's good, but everybody's on their phone. Everybody's talking over him. Everybody's kind of ignoring the guy in the corner playing the piano. Versus in the 70s at the Executive Lounge where Billy Joel played, people were coming to see the piano player. People were invested. There were no phones. There was nobody, you know, playing Candy Crush or whatever. They were there being in the moment with it. And you still get that connection to this album today, all those years later. It paints a picture that just works. One of the things that I love about this album, and I love about Billy Joel in general, is his albums are so varied, but they tell a consistent story. And we're going to talk about that a bunch tonight. We've complained in the past about albums that just feel like a mishmash of things that are just kind of thrown together. We had talked about Ed Sheeran a couple weeks ago and kind of his music style being incongruent across the album. There was just so much happening and being dropped in. And Billy Joel has this way of including pop music, Western cowboy kind of folk tunes, yuppie rock, really cool love ballads, which one of the songs on this album I did not put in the show notes, but I thought it was kind of funny. I was talking to my dad about this album last week as we were getting ready for the show, and he reminded me that the song You're My Home was the song my parents walked out of their wedding to. That was their walk down the aisle song. And I was just like, oh, that's like the perfect song to walk down the aisle to as a newly married couple. Which
it really is.
Full story, full swing back. I walked into our wedding with another Billy Joel song. So kind of like, there you go.
He really, to quote one of his own songs, he's got a way about him. I don't know what it is. And I think that the storytelling thing that you mentioned is thing number one. I have always thought, and I'm probably going to give some, but well, I don't think there are any Hollywood writers that listen to this podcast, but I have always thought that somebody needs to direct a Cheers style dramedy about a piano playing singer songwriter from the Bronx who moves out to California to get away from his record label and the stresses of fame. To play piano in a piano bar. And really, that's not like an interesting or unique thought, because that's what that song, like, that's the story that song is telling. I just, it's an idea that's rife with so much potential, you know, but that's not the only, you know, there are a ton of really great stories that he's telling on this album. Like Captain Jack is another tune that I listened to a lot as a kid that I probably shouldn't have.
Your mom really loved that song when you started singing along.
Yeah. Now, I don't think she knew that I knew that song or the words.
Was it really on the greatest hits album?
It was. Okay. It certainly was. It was so good. But, you know, it's this portrait of a spoiled rich kid at the end of its rope. It's this very, like, Great Gatsby kind of tale. And I was even thinking about it, listening to it this week. It mentions, he mentions in one of the lyrics, you know, they call the main character of the song to say they found his dad face down in his swimming pool, which is how they find Jay Gatsby. Spoilers for like a, what, like a 60-year-old novel? 70-year-old
novel. Way older than that, but okay, yeah.
Yeah,
it's coming up on 100 years old, I believe. I think it was 1928.
Well, you know what? This is a music podcast, not a literature podcast.
We don't even know how to read, y'all.
That's not entirely true. I do have some lovely pictograms for my show notes.
Oh, okay.
Which makes Captain Jack a really awkward song to read about. You know, like that is a thing that translated over even to me as a little kid that I think about a lot, that there are songs that create moods and atmospheres and don't have much to say, but there are also songs that say a whole lot. And I mean, you could probably fairly call Billy Joel's music lyrically dense.
Mm-hmm.
But he's such a good melody writer. You're talking about the difference between medley and melody. His melodies are just, it's incredible to me that he can cram so much in and none of it feels clumsy.
One of the things that I love about Billy Joel, and I overuse this phrase, but lyrically speaking, he is very dense on ideas, but vernacularly speaking, he is, anybody can understand him. You can take the lyrics at face value and understand exactly what they're saying. He doesn't use huge words. He doesn't use funky rhyming patterns to make something work. He doesn't, you know, syncopate anything in a weird way that you're kind of like trying to keep up with it. He's just laying it out there in a way that anybody can understand. And if you stop and think about it, you go, oh, shoot. Like, look at this. And we've talked a bunch about story so far. And this was one of the reasons this album is so high on my list. I love people. I love being around people. I love having conversations and being friendly with people. But at the end of the day, I kind of see myself through the eyes of all these different characters on this album. This album is kind of Billy Joel's opus on being the loner looking for a place to belong. Every song on this has to do with a person either kind of observing other people by himself, wondering where he fits, from Piano Man to Billy the Kid. That song's all about a loner who's looking for a home, and it ends up being the grave in which he's buried. Even in You're My Home, it's about a guy who's all by himself, and he's found the person that is going to be his home for the rest of his life. It doesn't matter if that's out on the Pennsylvania Turnpike or wherever, you know, Indiana's mountain plains, wherever it is, as long as he's with her, he's home. It's all about these loners who are finding their place to belong. And Captain Jack being the last song on the album, and that's the one character who doesn't get some sort of resolution throughout this whole album, is the thing that's just kind of like the twisting of the knife at the very end. Always loved. I mean, that's the one character without resolution at the end, and it's the last song on the album. I'm so happy about it right now. It's like, yes.
it's really rare, I think, that we get to discuss somebody whose album fits together as a cohesive whole ideologically. Of course, like a band like Pink Floyd, you know, it's like concept oriented rock. But you know, there are a lot of albums that aesthetically speaking, from a musical point of view, they fit, all the tracks fit together really well. There's a consistent feel. Even something like,
if it's AC/DC, it's the same song 12 times in a row.
Yeah, exactly. No. You just got to jumble the chords around, tell Angus Young to play. But something like this, you know, we joke about not being a literary podcast, but like I would say his, without getting too like hoity-toity, like I would say his songs are fairly literary. You know,
they're every man poetry, you know.
It's interesting to me because like Captain Jack, might as well just keep harping on the song. It's really, really about a rich dude who does not fit in with regular people. But he can turn around and write something like Worst Comes to Worst and really sounds like a regular dude, you know, just guy kind of bumming around from place to place. You were talking about his skill with the vernacular. You're going to have to bleep out a cuss because one of my favorite lines on this album, and if I don't have a car, I'll hitch. I got a thumb and she's a son of a like it's interesting to me. There are people that kind of play at being the working man's same thing with like Ain't No Crime. And I just think it's interesting that he has skill enough, not only in musical style, but also just as a writer to kind of capture the feeling of like being an everyman kind of guy, or at least writing those kind of characters convincingly. And you'll probably be able to speak to this better than I would. Did he grow up? I mean, did he grow up a rich man's son, or was he kind of a just like poor kid scraping by in the Bronx? What is his origins as a person?
And I think it's interesting. You know, Billy Joel is one of those musicians who, you know, early on, his father was a musician and immigrated to the United States to escape Nazi Germany, and met his mom in the Bronx at a Gilbert and Sullivan performance. And, you know, when Billy Joel was about 7 or 8 years, they got divorced and his dad went back to Europe, you know, in the late 1950s after everything had settled down. So throughout his formative years, he really was raised by a single mother who insisted that he learn the piano, even though it wasn't really something he was passionate about. And that's how we kind of ended up with the guy we've got today. He dropped out of high school in order to join a couple of bands. And by the time he was 24, he'd released this album. So it didn't all go bad for him, but he had a rough upbringing.
If you're playing Two Dudes in Tunes Bingo, put a chip on single Chris mother. And Wood. Well, yeah, put a chip on that because Dave Grohl, I believe, also was raised by a very independent single woman who I think encouraged him a lot in music. But I was going to say, put a chip on Chris and Wood get depressed at the success of artists who whom are putting out music like this. And this is his second album he put out at age 24.
Well, it's his second studio album. He'd released three albums before that, but we're not going to talk about them. They don't exist. They're not part of the canon.
But yeah, it's, you know, he has a real, I don't know, he seems to be somebody who does not let anything in his life go to waste as far as songwriting goes. He seems to have learned from everything.
Yeah.
That happened to him. But I want to pivot a little bit and let's talk about the variety of music.
Oh yeah,
on let's do Piano that. Man. Because you know, it's the album starts off with like four on the floor, foot stomping country. And I love, one of the things I love about this album that was really ear catching to me, a song I'd never heard before, because keep in mind, I've only listened to his best of albums up until this past week, was that the intro to that first song, Travel and Prayer, because so much of it is just, you know, just a little bit of, I want to say it's like the kick drum and some bass and him singing. You know, there's that little shuffling drum pattern. And then it just like explodes into like banjo and piano and stuff. And he, one of the things I love about his music in general is he writes a lot of really fast songs. You don't really think about the speed at which some of his tunes go until you like sit down and really think about it. Like his fingers are moving at a million miles an hour.
I've seen him live three times, once in an Elton John, like dueling pianos thing. And then twice just him by himself. And,
I'm so envious right now.
His current show, or the way he does shows nowadays, is he sits at the piano all night and he plays. And he's got just this giant three-ring binder of all the music he's ever released. And he takes polls from the audience. Do you want to listen to the, do you want to do this song or this song? And based on crowd participation, he picks the song. Well, he offered up to play. I can't even remember the song right now. And the audience was like, yes, we want to hear that one. He's like, yeah, well, I can't play it anymore. My fingers don't move that fast. And he moved right onto
the... Oh, no.
It was crushing. Awesome. Though. Like, what I loved about or love about his live performances is his interaction with the audience. He's a genuinely really funny guy. Like, he's telling jokes. He's making fun of the guitarist whose string just broke or the saxophonist who hit the wrong chord. And he stops the song because he's laughing so hard. Like, it's just a really intimate kind of thing to be in a room with 25,000 other people. And he's just having the time of his life out there doing whatever he feels like doing, basically.
Oh, I love that. Well, there's that life, you know, it is one thing to be a good performer, and it is an entirely different thing to capture the liveliness of your music mm-hmm. in an album. Mm-hmm. And he really does that here. One of the other tunes on this album, I mean, I like all of them, and I don't want to push us into the territory of talking about every single song. But if we're talking about genre, I'll try and rein myself in here. The song You're My Home is another kind of country tune. And it sounds like something straight out of John Denver's catalog.
It's got that finger picking kind of guitar. Like, it is so good.
But, you know, then he can turn around and do something like Ain't No Crime or Worst Comes to Worst that is like just like 70s rock to a T. Worst Comes to Worst shocked the heck out of me because I was like, what is this like wah guitar riff in a Billy Joel album? Like, I'm so accustomed to thinking of the piano playing balladeer, and then he rips into this like rock and roll showstopper. It's so good. That versatility is just unparalleled, I feel like.
I believe there's a recording out there of both Worst Comes to Worst and Ain't No Crime being covered by Aretha Franklin. And it is delightful. Just absolutely like a totally different spin.
Oh man. If there's any one person who could do his music better than him, it's Aretha Franklin. Like, that's a one person list.
A couple of Garth Brooks' biggest hits were written by Billy Joel. And I would say Garth Brooks did them better than Billy Joel. So
that is so funny. I had no idea he did writing outside of his own projects. That's pretty awesome. I mean, he did that one Disney movie about the dogs,
Oliver and Company. And like, come on, with Cheech Marin, and it was amazing.
That okay. A really shameful gap in my movie watching as a child. I've never seen Oliver and Company.
I saw the ad
for it a million times. I know it's terrible. I need to look on Disney Plus. I'm sure it's
Cheech Marin plays the voice of a chihuahua who's in love with Bette Midler, who's French bulldog or
of
French poodle.
He does.
And he's amazing. A street dog just trying to impress her, and she just wants to be at home. So it's great.
I love it.
He carjacks somebody at some point in the movie and tells them that he's ready to go to Atlantic City.
Oh man, Cheech Marin is one of those people who delights me whenever I find him in anything. But you know, there are other style, like, so the thing I think that I texted you, and I don't want to like hold sway over mm-hmm. this because it's your album, but this whole album has a very Broadway mm-hmm. feel. There's a lot of really big orchestration, like as much as he dips a toe in other styles, something like Ballad of Billy the Kid. Like, when I heard that song, I was like, yeah, of course Wood likes this. It's like Billy Joel does Hamilton.
It's,
you know, like
it's theater kid crack.
It is. But you know, that song is so interesting to me because it's this song about the Wild West and about Billy the Kid. And if it weren't for the intro, you know, that has that little like do 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 and the little like clip clop sound mm-hmm. effect, whatever, you know, like two coconuts or whatever Monty Python device they've rigged up. If it weren't for that, you wouldn't know that it was a Wild West tune. Like, if he had not had that intro, you could easily like miss the lyrics about Billy the Kid and just think like, well, boy, this is a fun show tune that Billy Joel is playing right now.
That tune is really fun to me because of the intro verse and the outro verse. So there's a lot of fun stuff in there. I love the storytelling it is, but that's one of the songs. The verse at the very beginning is, from a town known as Wheeling, West Virginia, rode a boy with a six gun in his hand, and his daring life of crime made him a legend in his time east and west of the Rio Grande. The very last verse of the song is, the music is kind of fading out, and it's basically just Billy Joel's voice and back to that ding, 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 ding kind of tune. Mm-hmm. Is from a town known as Oyster Bay, Long Island, rode a boy with a six pack in his hand, and his daring life of crime made him a legend in his time east and west of the Rio Grande. So you get that tie-in of him seeing himself through the eyes of Billy the Kid, and there's a lot of that to him. I mean, he wrote this song while he's in exile from his recording contract and hiding. It just, it's so cool. And there is a very theatrical quality to the whole thing. I think of Billy Joel kind of as one of those like shameless self-promoters. Like, he knows how to tell a story and how to sell something really, really, really well. It just happens to be he's talking about himself.
Yeah, but, you know, like, you have to have that kind of confidence and knowledge of self to make music like this. And I'm not the kind of person who wants to necessarily promote the myth of, like, the great man. And I know you and I have some, like, differing thoughts on, like, individuality and stuff. But, man, like, with when the product of that mindset is this, it makes it awfully hard to argue with it, you know, like, because he really has this persistence of vision and he has this clarity with which he pursues like what he wants to do. And I don't necessarily want to like shut out whoever else might be involved, because I know he worked with the same band for a long time, right? Like, the band he recorded with was like the same for a while, wasn't it?
He worked with a lot of kind of rotating musicians, but whoever he recorded the album with was generally who he went on tour with for that album. And over the course of the years, it's not like George Strait and the Ace and the whole band, where it's the same core guys that's been there the whole time. You'll have guys that rotate in for 3 or 4 years with Billy Joel and then rotate out and rotate back in. One of the guys I really wanted to hit on, because I think his impact on this album is immeasurable, is the drummer, which is Ron Tutt, T-U-T-T.
Oh, nice. I'm glad you mentioned him, because I mentioned him in the show notes as well. That dude is a beast.
He is a beast. And what I just absolutely like about him, I mean, so he's the drummer on the first 9 tracks of the album. The only one he did not do was Captain Jack, which is not a drum heavy song really either. So, there is a drummer on that track, and I'm dumb and didn't write it down. But when we talk about Mr. Tutt, what I really liked about him, he played for Billy Joel on this album and on Billy Joel's next album, Street Life Serenade, which came out a couple years later. So he's one of those guys who was only around for a fairly narrow window of time. He also never toured with Billy Joel, because up until 1976, he was touring with Elvis Presley. He was Elvis's original drummer, and he played in the Taking Care of Business band until 1977, when Elvis passed away and the band broke up. Huh. So he was Elvis's drummer. After Elvis passed away, he played in the Jerry Garcia band. And then since 1978, he has been the touring and recording drummer for Neil Diamond. So a lot of staying power, really cool drum signatures on this album. And a lot of that has to be spoken into by him, I'm sure. You know, it's not Billy Joel dictating you have to play it this way, because it's just so
drummers
alive.
It really is. Like, since we're still kind of talking about the Ballad of Billy the Kid, that the first time I was listening through to this album was on my way to work, and I had to sit in the parking lot of my workplace and finish The Ballad of Billy the Kid, not the least of which is for the drum fills in that mm-hmm. song, because that dude does not, he dials it up to 11 the whole song. Like as soon as the chords of the beginning really like come in big, he is just like a fill every other like phrase that he gets. And it is so good.
And his fills in that song remind me of a steam locomotive coming into town. Yeah. Like it's just got that cadence to it. It's just so good. But mm-hmm. he's a phenomenal drummer even to this day. And he's one of those people that when you see his credit on an album like this, you immediately know, oh my goodness, this is going to be really great. I mean, the guy played for Elvis his entire career and then has continued on to play for Neil Diamond since then. So I just thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah, a lot of these older, I hate saying older musicians because it makes me sound like a young buck, but like these are guys who spent 365 days a year playing. And when you think about Billy Joel's own history as a musician up to this album, like he did the same thing. Is since childhood, he's been working on playing music mm-hmm. and writing songs. And I think, you know, it's easy for us to get frustrated or like, oh man, like why are all these people so good at what they do so young? It's because they started young. You know, you look at athletes, actors, mm-hmm. any of those people, they've started really young. But I want to pivot a little bit. I don't know if we need to move on or not, but I just want to talk a little bit about the kind of Beatles-y mm-hmm. sound of some of Billy Joel's music, because I just love it. Piano Man is like a very, it's a very Paul mm-hmm. type of progression. But then in If I Only Had the Words to Tell You, that's like a very, it sounds to me a lot like something George Harrison would write.
Yep.
And I think it's no surprise him being kind of a baby boomer and growing up in the 60s that the Beatles had such an influence. But it's rare, I think, at least I find it rare to hear somebody who actually kind of captures those sensibilities in a way that's not either derivative like the Monkees or just so subtle as to be impossible to find.
Yeah, and I will go a step further and say it's more of a homage to those musicians than it is an impersonation of them. Like, even through it all, he manages to be his own unique self.
Absolutely. It's
kind of cool because this is so early in his career. Billy Joel is one of those artists who definitely has a strong career progression. As you go throughout mm-hmm. his discography, you know, from oldest to newest, you can see the musician who develops, the storyteller who develops. He becomes more nuanced. He becomes, in some cases, a lot angrier. There's a point in his life where he, and I personally feel like it's his best album, but we're not going to reveal it here because still on the list. There's a point in his life where he was just so angry at the world. I mean, this is the guy who wrote a song about an angry young man.
That's a good song too.
There's an entire album that's basically around just how disappointed in life he is in general. And it came out towards the end of his recording career. And that album is just so poignant in comparison to this album, which is a young guy with some hope leading into the future, but still looking for his place to here he is later on in life. And he's kind of got the same problem. He feels like a visionary who's left behind because he didn't meet the status quo or whatever. And seeing that progression through his music, seeing the way he develops as a storyteller is a real treat. And it's something we didn't get to see from the Beatles, even from the solo work of, you know, Paul McCartney and Ringo and to an extent, George Harrison, when he was still with us, we really didn't see mm-hmm. that development because I feel like in a lot of ways they were putting on an act more than just being themselves. And that's what makes Billy Joel so unique, is it's just a guy talking about life.
Yeah. Well, and you know, as far as the Beatles go, I think with Paul's music, and this is kind of a slight tangent, but since our small talk was 5 minutes, because I had nothing to do but talk about this album, I think we can afford to squeeze in a little like miniature like Beatles hour. You know, Paul's music, you can kind of see a growth stylistically. I don't know enough about his songwriting to know like the ins and outs of his like personal changes in the same way that you're acquainted with Billy Joel, but George Harrison's music really kind of pushed him to the forefront and kind of made people think like, oh, like he really was super talented. And I think that's what makes part of what makes some of Billy Joel's work that's influenced by them so pleasing, is he was picking up on stuff that we didn't yet know about, like George Harrison specifically. And it, you know, probably a lot of this is just us extrapolating based on what we've heard, but especially in If I Only Had the Words, you know, that intro lick to that song sounds a lot like the Beatles tune. I'll probably get the title wrong, but I think it's just called Something. You know, that guitar lick that has such a weird little chord progression under it. There's a lot of that in If I Only Had the Words. But like you said, it's very much Billy Joel's own style. You can just tell that that's a gear that he has in him, and that's an influence of his. And that kind of musical complexity is something I really love about him. You know, like I said, I've been binging his albums just this week. And there are albums after this one that I think the chord progressions get a lot more complex. He kind of delves into some more jazz harmonies, and maybe the melodies go to some weird or different places. But this album has that kind of, I mean, I hesitate to say simplicity, but it has that accessibility that I think makes this album so excellent, because there's plenty of complexity to be had in the parts and maybe some of the harmonies. But overall, this is just really straightforward storytelling with a lot of class and a lot of style. And I think that's one of the things that that just makes this album so like captivating, is how it's not him being experimental, but it does feel like him flexing, you know, compared to his first album. This is like, okay, I've gotten that trash out of the way. They screwed up my first project. I'm going to come in and knock it out of the park.
Yeah,
so to speak. And I think that he really does on this album.
Well, I think as you get more experience in his discography moving forward, you're going to find that he hits just about every album out of the park. Like the deep cuts are great.
Oh, yeah.
The hits are great. They all kind of have a theme that kind of flows throughout them. And this is just the toe in the water kind of moment. I think we've kind of gotten through this one. If you're ready to move on to critical reception.
Absolutely. Let's talk about it.
This album was mediocrely reviewed.
It's incredible.
No, it was a massive success, both here in the United States and in the UK. Rolling Stones, represents said that Piano Man represents a new seriousness and flexibility for Joel, comparing it to the stylings of Elton John. And then Billboard stated that it shows that Joel has a fine shot at establishing himself as consistent quality AM artist with large scale songs and dynamic performing range, which is kind of a put down in its way. Like that is, he's got a chance of being an AM artist.
They didn't have the benefit of hindsight as we do to know that saying that Billy Joel has a shot is like saying that like Babe Ruth has some promise.
Yeah, he might be able to hit a home run someday. But
Brett Favre's got a decent arm. He's pretty good.
Oh, but I think it's kind of funny. The album was, I mean, just there are no review aggregates or Metacritic for this album. But even today, this album kind of shares the distinction of being a 3 out of 5 star kind of album for most period pieces that reviewed it. And it was a massive success for Billy Joel. It launched him into superstardom basically overnight. He was a known commodity at the time, but all of a sudden he was right up there with Elton John as, is this the piano man of the generation? And we didn't really do a whole lot of comparing Elton John to Billy Joel, but their careers are kind of in parallel. Their music style's kind of in parallel. If you had to flip a coin and pick one, who would it be? And you can be honest.
Well, I mean, I'm definitely, I've got recency bias. I would have to pick Billy Joel just because I, even as much as I've heard both of their kind of greatest hits, I would have to go with Billy Joel. Although if you're going to put people head to head as far as like which ballads they've written, man, Elton John, he's got some good ones, but so, I'm going to have to go Billy Joel in the spirit of this episode, if for no other reason.
I pick Billy Joel too. I said in the intro, he's my favorite musician and storyteller of all time. So I'm not going to default from that. I'm going to say my familiarity with Elton John's music is pretty deep. My problem with his music is his hits are the hits and his deep cuts really don't count. You start listening to his albums and he'll have 10 songs on an album. 4 of them will be great. 2 of them will be okay. And the rest of them will be just trash filling the album. And that's a hot take from me. But if you're comparing greatest hits versus greatest hits, they seem like they're on level and, you know, the same basically. I love Elton John, so don't get me wrong. And I love what a character Elton John is. I mean, anybody who wears wooden pants on stage automatically gets a like from me. Eccentricity is.
So where do you stand on Lady Gaga, who famously wore a dress made of meat to something?
I joked the time that she did that because you were living in the apartment when she did that here in San Antonio. And I remember making a joke to you about all I needed was a smoker. I was ready to go.
The most delicious dress in the world.
It's like, that's a different opinion on edible arrangements. Let's go.
Yeah, that is the most edible arrangement.
She's a wonderful musician and artist too, by the way. I refuse to drag her because she is amazing.
Yeah, in my younger, more impressionable years, I would occasionally drag her for being quote unquote weird, which is before I realized that we need more weird people in the world.
Yeah. She's amazing. I love her.
And she is, so the gal that I do shows with here in town, Mackenzie, she sings a couple of Lady Gaga tunes that are just absolutely stellar. One of them is from her, it's not A Star Is Born, but it's that movie. Mm-hmm. The other one is called Joanne, and it's a phenomenal tune. But talk about really driven individuals. She's definitely in the same league, I would say, as Billy Joel, as far as like she has a vision, she's able to execute it. And she's an entertainer. You don't wear a dress made of meat without an idea for like, what is going to provoke people here?
Well, and the thing that I love about her and Billy Joel, likewise, is the sense of knowing, you know, the first thing you need to do is know thyself. And they know who they are and where they fit.
They really do.
And I respect the heck out of that. They don't try to fit in. They don't try to blend in. They're just going to do their thing. And So that's enough for Lady Gaga hour. Let's talk about reviews.
This, listeners, you are getting a 3-for-1. We've talked about Elton John, 2 out of the 4 Beatles. We've talked about Lady Gaga. But anyway, before we get into our reviews, I just want to remind everybody of our review scheme, which is 1 to 6 strings on a guitar. One string is an album that lost its jewel case and just kind of scrapes along the floorboards of your car. I know that we all had that album, and you know, you get to the time where you're going to clean out your car and take it through the car wash, and you just throw that album away. That is a 0 out of 6 strings. 6 strings is the album that you furiously burned copies of back when burning copies of a CD was a thing. This is a 6-string album.
First, you ran the risk of pirating and downloading every virus on the internet while you were torrenting it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure.
I mean, it was like roulette. Do I get a virus or the music I want?
Let's see. Torrent was one. What was the other one?
Napster, LimeWire.
LimeWire was the one. That was my piracy software of choice, which in retrospect was just such poor judgment on my part. I should have just spent money on music. But anyway, I'm going to get my review out of the way so we can give you the last word on this, your most favorite of musicians. So like I said, at the top of the episode, I have always enjoyed Billy Joel's music. And that's very literally true. You know, like I said, 2nd or 3rd grade was about where Billy Joel popped on my radar. Piano Man is a song that I kind of look at as an Aristotelian ideal of songwriting. You know, it's the thing in the back of my head that I always wish that I wrote. And so at the onset of this week, listening to this album, I was really excited to hear the album that the song comes from. Far from being disappointed, I was blown away. I didn't have any negative preconceptions to begin with, but if I had, they would have all been eliminated. Because of the things we talked about, Billy Joel has an almost virtuosic ability to capture different genres of music. As a storyteller, he can kind of speak in different voices. Something we didn't talk about is the track. It's the track about the woman who leaves her husband and makes a stop in Nevada. That might be the song. And while I'm not about to present that song as any kind of feminist anthem, he was thinking about writing a song from that woman's point of view. You know, and that's just one of the things that I think makes him an interesting songwriter, is he thinks a lot about the characters in his song. He's not just trying to write a song for the sake of writing a song. He's writing songs to tell stories. You know, and having scoped out some of the other albums of his, I might have picked a different one. But that just comes down to aesthetic details and preferences of me personally. I don't think that there's anything you can really knock on this album. So I'm going to give it 6 strings or 87 keys or whatever a piano has. You've told me, and I still don't remember. So he gets all the keys on the piano and 6 strings of a guitar to boot.
Very nice. Like I said earlier, I remember fondly the first time I heard this album in the back of my dad's 1984 FJ60, the car that basically defined me for 10 years of my life. I was completely blown away. And I said that earlier. It's not even a stretch for me to say a second time. I was a young guy in search of my niche, my people, and my purpose. And here was this album that my dad just nonchalantly popped into a brand new CD player for his own nostalgia. I mean, my dad was 13 when this album came out. And it just spoke to me on a level that not many albums had yet at that time or have since that time. It was something I immediately connected to. This guy named Billy Joel, who's this outsider who's doing his own thing and looking for, you know, what his place in the world is going to be while being true to himself and being true to the person he wanted to become. And through that, in the 1970s, he managed to make the zenith of musicdom. This album really does not place a single foot wrong. It's one of those albums that I feel is just about perfect in every way, shape, and form. You mentioned last week texting me that it was interesting that I would pick this album, that it didn't have all the hits on it, that it didn't have the whole Billy Joel experience kind of in one. But my personal opinion is that each of these songs is phenomenal in its own way. And here in a moment, I'm going to cry over naming a least favorite song, literally, because they're all phenomenal.
How do you like it?
Yeah, exactly. This album is almost prophetic. It came across in the 1970s, and the content of the album is just as applicable today as it was in 1973. Billy Joel released this, and in 1973, he was 24 years old. So again, the what have I done with the last 10 years of my life, because I'm still standing here with a podcast and you as my friend, and that's about it.
Gee, thanks.
Hey, we're doing okay.
Yeah, I agree.
I just really love that this album is a thinly veiled anti-establishment manifesto about rebellion. Billy Joel went and hid. You know, his record label was in New York, and he moved to Los Angeles for 6 months and played for tips in a piano bar so that the record label could not find him. And he wrote some of the most endearing classics of his career while doing that. To me, I'm so connected to this album. This album was his first mega hit. It sold 5 million copies in its first year, went 5 times platinum in the United States. So it definitely connected with this audience, despite what the reviewers thought about Billy Joel, the musician. And every song tells a supporting story that unifies the end of the album in a way that we don't get to see. Or we don't get to see very often, at least, in music. The story reminds me to be my true self, and I really like that. This album gets a full 88 keys. Always on an even number, Chris.
There we go.
And it also gets It also gets a neck-mounted harmonica, because one thing we didn't talk about in this album is the fact that Billy Joel plays piano and harmonica while singing at the same time throughout the whole thing. So it is a sight to behold. He also looks like Darth Vader when doing it now. So
poor guy.
That said, 6 out of 6 strings. It's the perfect album to me.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. We've given probably a lot of 6 out of 6 strings. And it's only when we encounter each other's albums that we start, oh, I didn't like it that much. Start dinging them.
Actually, you know, it's funny. I was looking at that the other day, and I meant to start compiling a list of what each of us reviewed each of the albums. Mm-hmm. The vast number of ratings between the two of us is actually a 4 out of 6. And we're generally the most critical to our own albums. So even though it feels like we get a lot of 6 out of 6s, there are not that many of them. So
we've just hit a good stretch lately.
We've had some great albums the last 4 or 5 episodes.
I would hope so. It's they're our favorite albums. So if we're picking stuff we don't like, there's something inherently wrong with us. Speaking of things we like and don't like, why don't we move on to favorite and least favorite track? Do you want to go first or do you want me to go first? What do you want to do?
Pass. No, I'll go first with my favorite track because I'll be fair. This is like picking a favorite and least favorite child, which basically comes down to which one didn't bug me the most today. Which one did exactly what I needed to do? Which one did exactly what I needed to do right when I told them to do it? And
hey, there you go. Exactly.
So for right now at this phase in my life, throughout the years, let me say, back up and say, throughout the years, different tracks on this album have been my favorite. I've loved the song Captain Jack at specific points in my life. I've loved the Ballad of Billy the Kid. And right now, the track that just connects with me the most is Worst Comes to Worst. I just love the imagery of that song. It's kind of an island-themed piano bar song that tells the world that I'm going to be doing my own thing, and worst comes to worst, I'll get along. I don't know how, but somehow I will. And that's just, that's just life. And I connect with it in a way that, you know, both just, it's so real to me. So that's my favorite. What was your favorite song?
So going into this album, I expected my favorite track to be Piano Man. And of course, I still definitely love that track. But the song that kept getting stuck in my head that I returned to the most was Ain't No Crime. Ain't No Crime. And I forget, there's another one. It might have been Worst Comes to Worst. But he's got some really gospel-y tunes.
Both of them kind of have the same tone. And,
yeah. And it's that kind of like brassy, irreverent sort of feel that I love about some of his songs.
Both of these tracks are some of the fastest tracks on the album too. Like he's really cooking on these.
You know, like I think now looking back at the decade of the 70s, some people kind of sneer a little bit at Billy Joel being a rock and roll musician, because there was a lot of guitar driven stuff that was a lot heavier. Punk was getting started in the 70s. And so while I think it's fair to look back and say, okay, maybe Billy Joel wasn't the cutting edge of rock and roll, whatever that means, he definitely understood that ethos, you know. And Ain't No Crime is like, it's like a party animal anthem, and it's so good. Like, I'm such a square, so I think I have to live vicariously through that song, but I just love everything about it.
To kind of wrap up that thought, I feel like Billy Joel is the godfather of 1980s yacht rock. This album is just 7 years before its time.
Like, man, and some of his other stuff, like if you listen to 52nd Street, I don't want to push us into like a Billy Joel retrospective, but man, 52nd Street, the song Rosalinda straight up sounds like a Steely Dan tune. And there's a lot of like jazz and slick production. The other tune that I've been like listening to nonstop is Zanzibar. That also sounds like ripped straight off of Asia or something like that. It is so good. But yeah, he's dude has a head on his shoulders as far as music goes. What was your least favorite? I'm deeply curious because I bet it's going to be hard.
It is. You know, it's next to impossible to pick a song off of a 6-string album that you just don't like. The song that I would throw away if I had to throw one away is actually one that I had a lot of affinity for earlier in my life. It's one of the tracks that I identified with, not because I was a spoiled rich kid, but because I had a lot of trouble with finding a sense of purpose in my life. And I was raised lower middle class by parents who worked their tails off. And there was a lot of time to just wonder, well, what am I going to do out of this life? How am I going to measure up and all that? And so the track that I've kind of outgrown in the years since I had such an affinity for it is Captain Jack. And we talked a lot about it. It is a phenomenal song. It's the story of a young man with no path, a silver spoon in life, the whole thing. And, you know, there was a phase where I identified with that character and kind of the helpless, listless, I don't even know what to do with myself kind of thing. And it wasn't until my second year in college that I really burst out of that and really had a path and the thing that I wanted to do with my life. And you know, as an adult, as a parent, I look at that character and it's one of the things that keeps me awake at night raising a son. Like, how do I prevent mm-hmm. my son from having that experience? How do I, yeah. And you got, it's a dangerous slope because if you just provide for him, all of a sudden he's the one with the silver spoon and he's in that cycle that you're trying to prevent. So what's the balance yep. and how do you make that work? What's the place that you go? And so because of that, and then I also mentioned it earlier, this is the last track on the album. And I love the fact that this character really doesn't get any resolution. It's the only character mm-hmm. in the entire album that doesn't have a bow tied on the end of the story. It's left open-ended for you to figure out at the end. And it kind of feeds into Street Life Serenade, his next album, which opens on kind of a tie-in type track. But for you, the listener of just this album at this moment in time, it's the one that leaves you with no resolution. It's the one that leaves you with questions. And we mentioned Christopher Nolan last week and his ability to leave movies open for interpretation at the end. You know, at the end of Inception, does the teeter-totter, the little spinny thing fall over? At the end of Dunkirk, yeah. is the pilot at... Tom Hardy shot Ed Hardy. Wowwood is the guy in the flannel shirts shot. Tom Hardy is Tom Hardy shot close. By the Nazis. Like, those questions, I don't feel like belong on this album. It's one of those loose ends that just doesn't work for me. So that's the one I'm going to throw away. Fair. It's a phenomenal song. Yeah. Don't skip it. What about you? What was your least favorite?
So before I get on to my least favorite, I just want to say, Captain Jack has one of my favorite verses mm-hmm. in any song because of the character building in it. So verse 4, so you stand on the corner in your new English clothes and you look so polished from your hair down to your toes. Oh, but your fingers gonna pick your nose after all. And like, the only songwriter I know who's ever worked nose picking into a song and made it like, oh man, this guy is putting on airs and he's just in an empty vessel. No, yep. no, nothing going on, no direction. But anyway, I just wanted to point that out because I think it's
a great line.
It is. So my least favorite track committed one of my 7 deadly musical sins, which is changing the key up a step or like half a step, just for cheap emotional heightening. And that's the song, If I Only Had the Words. Now, I part of the reason this is my least favorite song is because it's one of my favorite melodies and chord progressions on the album. And he just kind of, it's the one song that he just sort of stand and delivers. Like, he just kind of plows through the whole thing at a pace that I think is too fast. I think he could have slowed it down a little bit at the beginning and taken a little bit more time to tell that story. Mm-hmm. And so that's gotta be my least favorite track, but man, I like, honestly, I had this song stuck in my head all this week too. Cause his melodies are fantastic. I just think the execution on this song left me wanting more.
This song has really powerful lyrics. It's one of those love songs that kind of transcends time. And it's kind of a play on, you know, of course, if I only had the words to tell you, if I only had the time, if you only had the time to understand, though I know you wouldn't change your feelings, and I know you'll carry on the best you can, is the opening verse. And every verse after that's kind of a modification of that. So instead of words, it's urge. After that, it's a song to sing. After that, if it's you know, arms to hold you. It's just this gut-wrenching song, and it is kind of cheapened by the key changes throughout it. If he had just picked something and stuck to it, I think it would have been better too. But I love that song, so I'm disappointed in you, Chris. No.
Well, if I only had the words, to tell you.
Oh, you're telling me. I'm not listening at this point.
you, if you are the lady in that song, you've got your fingers in your ears going, la, 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 la. Yeah,
exactly. Which is also a lyric in that song.
yeah, it is for quite a bit. Very 70s of him to A, do a key change, and to B, have a lot of the lyrics just be la, da, da. Da, 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 which that bridge where he sings that is my favorite part of the song because the chord progression is so cool. It's got this like neat like descending thing. But anyway, let's get out of favorite and least favorite songville before I start blathering on about chord progressions and see what the Oracle has foretold for us.
All right, man. Well, we're picking from your list this week. Which still has right at about 40 albums on it. So let's see what the Oracle gives us. Number 4, which is Jackson Emmer's 2020 album, Alpine Coda.
Oh, man, I'm so glad that we're doing this. This is an artist that I wish more people knew about. And so I'm hoping that our 5 or 6 listeners will go tell 5 or 6 of their friends, and those friends tell those friends. It's exponential.
You're it's selling like a pyramid scheme.
But our, not near,
our, yeah, our podcast not is a pyramid scheme now.
Yeah, yeah. Pyramid scheme or a virus that hopefully will spread good music to everyone.
As long as we aren't a Ponzi scheme and we don't have to pay it forward, we're good.
You cannot, in the style of Jim, draw a triangle over this. You can really just draw a straight line because it's you and me. So it's a rectangle scheme, I guess.
Well, folks, thank you so much for listening. If you've been enjoying our show, please rate and review it on your podcatcher of choice. We promise to read your reviews no matter what they are. I check our email religiously, so don't let it get dusty. Chris, why don't you give him that email address and get us out of this show and on to next week?
Absolutely. So if you want to get in touch with us, shoot us an email at twodudesandtunes@gmail.com. You can also hit us up on Instagram or Facebook. I'm kind of manning the ones and twos on both of those social media sites. I will be quick to respond because there are plenty of lulls in my work day. Tell us what you thought of Piano Man. Tell us what you thought of this episode. And don't forget to tune in next Wednesday where we head westward to the mountains to enjoy an alpine coda. We'll see y'all next week. It'll give us more time to bloviate about Billy Joel.
I feel like that's the episode title, and we weren't even really recording. Bloviating about awesome. Billy Joel.
Yes, there we go.